Okay, so last time, interesting. Oh, I see what I did here. I guess I'll do this. Okay, so last time I talked about EGP some more. So we mentioned, you know, after going over our kind of two types of relationships, our customer-provider and peer-to-peer, mentioned that there's some other preferences that we have when going between two parties. So one is that, you know, typically if we have two large entities, they'll connect in multiple places. Like, often you'll do this if only for redundancy. So we saw that, like, UVA's main ISP, that Maria Educational Network, has a point of presence in Northern Virginia and in Atlanta, and probably the main reason they do that is that if something happens in Ashburn, they don't want to have no internet. So we'll have multiple locations, and typically we'll have a preference in that this is kind of a business decision about, you know, do I send the packets to the closest place to from where I'm getting them, which saves me money? Do I send them to the closest place to where the other party will use them, which is going to get me better performance, but probably cost me more money? And that's kind of a business decision. And we mentioned that BGP has this concept for communicating these preferences called that it calls the multi-exit discriminator. Then we talked about kind of the overall picture of BGP. We said that, like, somewhat confusingly, that BGP is used both between different entities, called exterior BGP, and sometimes used within an entity called interior BGP, because if I have 20 routers that connect to other entities, I want to know, coordinate between all of them, what are all the paths out of our network we have. So interior BGP, you know, is one way to do that. Probably you can also do that with something OSPF-like instead of using the BGP protocol. So we said, okay, what do BGP announcements look like? And one of the sort of key features that BGP chose is that, well, we have to solve the count to infinity problem. That if we look at BGP, it's really a distance vector routing protocol. That we're basically getting from our neighbors, I can send traffic to A, B, C, and D, you know, that's what I'll accept. And, you know, if we follow the distance vector routing style, you know, we're gonna choose some of those to actually choose as our next hop. So that's BGP is essentially applied distance vector routing, but we have the count to infinity problem. That we know if we don't do anything, we can have kind of loops, and especially if some node temporarily goes down or something like that. And kind of our main mechanism in BGP for avoiding loops is this notion of autonomous system paths, that we have a list of the networks that the route went through to get here, and duplicates on that list tell us we have a loop somewhere, we shouldn't do that. We just disallow it. So then we have the issue of, like, how do we actually decide between two different paths we get via BGP? If I'm running my ISP and I have two places that are telling me that they will let me get to 1.2.3/24, that network, if I'm sending a packet to 1.2.3.4, which one of those do I choose? And we learned that there's kind of a typical set of rules that are used, but of course, you know, this is all up to whoever is configuring the network. And the kind of rule that's most ubiquitous is that we pretty much always use the shortest the most specific prefix, meaning that if I have 1.2.3.0/24 and 1.2.3.0/23, which is really 1.2.3. These both cover 1.2.3.4, right? If I'm sending traffic to 1.2.3.4, I could use either of these. BGP's sort of most specific rule says that when we have this choice, we always choose the smaller set of addresses. After that, we have kind of this local preference idea. So typically what will happen is when you import routes, you might say, I have a much better path to, Ashburn than Atlanta. I'm going to prefer routes that go through Ashburn. So you might, system administrator will set these local preference values that will be used next to decide between routes. Then, if we still have a tie between two ways of getting traffic out of our network, typically we use the AS path length. The notion being that this kind of approximately tells us that if I have, how many networks the path is going to go through, right? If I have an AS path length of 3 versus an AS path length of 2, right, that suggests it's a shorter path. It's not a guarantee because, networks are different sizes. So one of the ASs on the AS path might be a network that spans the globe, and the others might be ones that are sort of more tightly connected and things go very quickly through. So it's not a guarantee, but it's a typical good heuristic, and we don't have the full information about which is better. And we saw that one thing that I, as someone who's running a network that I want to get traffic sent to, can do is I can decide to some extent which path people will use to send traffic to me by adding things artificially to the AS path. And we saw UVA does this because we have this sort of network connection we mostly don't want to use, but we want to still have available, that we just prefix 8 copies or 7 extra copies of our AS to the AS path. So everyone will say, well, this is like a way, I'm only going to use this if my other paths to your network either don't exist or are 7 longer for people following, 7 hops longer, or hop is another entity. So then, we might use the multi-exit discriminator value, and I said maybe because that's a policy choice. Like, do I want to, follow the other party's preference of sending traffic closer to them, or do I want to make that their problem? And then typically our tiebreaker would be the best local route. So, I'm going to just say if I have two routers I could send the traffic out of them, one of them is probably closer to the machine that's starting, that's sending it. I'm going to use that one, or faster from the machine. Then we also talked about this idea of internet exchanges. So we mentioned that, you can have ISPs that kind of connect directly to each other, where you just lease a line or build a line between them. But a very common thing to do is that you want to connect to lots of people. And a kind of entity that exists all over the place that enables this are these internet exchanges, who basically run this very fast kind of local network, usually in one or a couple data centers in a region. And the idea is that you can buy a connection to that network, and that connects you to a lot of other networks that might be too small for you to be interested in kind of directly getting a leased line to each of them. And we mentioned that these internet exchanges sometimes run what we call route servers, meaning that rather than you having to make a BGP connection to each of the 100 people who use the Boston Internet Exchange, you can instead connect to the Massachusetts Internet Exchange's route server and send your routes to them, and they'll send all the BGP announcements everyone sends to you kind of consolidated in one connection. And that's, makes it sort of more efficient for you. So then we started talking about DNS, which we'll continue today. And we mentioned that DNS, we have this hierarchy where we divide up our domains into zones. And these zones might not correspond exactly to the levels of our hierarchy because, for example, you know, we might say that the same people who manage the same zone that has virginia.edu will have its.virginia.edu and things under it because we don't want to separate out that responsibility. Continue with that. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay. Any questions on the assignment? So I guess something I'll mention on the assignment, which has definitely been the most common issue I've seen in office hours, is dealing with thinking about removal. So I think a lot of people are under the impression that, okay, so we have, when I delete a link, I'm just going to update all the routing information based on that. And that's not going to be the full story. So, for example, if we delete this link here, and let's say I have, this is cost 10 here, and 1, 1, 1, 1. If I delete this link, the easy thing to do is for this node here to realize that its next hop to, we'll say this is A, the next hop from B to A, you know, doesn't exist anymore. But it can't figure out by itself, you know, right away that the path is through B. It's going to need to wait for a periodic update from them. Also, we're going to need this node to realize it doesn't go through B anymore. How is that going to happen? Well, B here is going to send a message, that contains one of these two messages, depending on when it sends it, to update the information about it. And we need to update at this node, let's say this is C. You know, so C is initially going to have a distance vector that says A is cost 2 via B. And it needs to get this update and change this to be not use B anymore. And that's something people often miss, is that you need to have logic that increases cost when you learn that the way you were going doesn't work anymore. So questions about that. And one other corner case that comes up sometimes. If this link goes down, you need to somehow figure out to go this way. So you should think about, you should think about how that's going to happen. Okay. Are there any assignment questions? Good. Okay. So there's one last thing I'd like to talk about with routing that I missed over. And this is kind of a practical concern. So when we're talking about BGP, like it seems like basically I get a list of routes to every single person who's announcing anything. And that's actually really big. And a lot of networks don't want to deal with that. It's hard to have routers that support that. But, you know, so, and the simple solution is that, you know, I have an ISP, I just send everything to that ISP. But if you have two ISPs, that doesn't really work. Like, what do you do then? So you can take a partial set of those routes and have a default is a common strategy you might use. So you might have take some of those routes. So for example, you might look at the ones with just a short AS path where probably you want to choose a particular ISP for that. And you'll have a default route that you'll sort of code in your OSPF instance or something like that for the other cases, where you just say everything, you know, where this is a way of writing every IP address goes to one of the ISP links. Or maybe both of the ISP links with equal plus multipath. And one of the reasons why that more specific idea works is because it makes this really easy. You just encode this route that includes everything, and the more specific routes automatically take precedence over it. But this is kind of a common practical concern, is that we actually want to kind of summarize the routes in some way. Because the full internet routing table, I don't know what it is now, but historically, if you consolidate routes down, it's often, like, meaning that, like, if you say I have 1.2.3, 24, and 1.2.4, 224, right? We can combine these into 1.2.2.223, right? So if you do that as much as possible, even if you do that as much as possible, I've heard a story, you know, not like 10 years ago, it was like 150,000 entries, which that's, you need a pretty expensive router to handle efficiently. So questions on sort of our getting partial internet routing tables? Okay. So last time we were talking about DNS connection, we had this division into zones. The zones don't sort of kind of correspond to our hierarchy, but not in a way where like each zone needs to be exactly one level. We can have these zones kind of span multiple levels. This is an administrative division, like each zone has a separate person writing the configuration files and choosing what entries are there. And between the zones, we can have a way of sort of delegating from one zone to another. We'll look at exactly what that looks like in a bit. And there's going to be different types of DNS servers. So we mentioned this and we've kind of seen both of them. So we have DNS servers that are authoritative for some zone. So these are ones which are claimed to be an official source for information about that zone, and they're not giving a cached version they learned elsewhere. They are the source of the information that you can cache later. And then there are DNS servers that are so-called recursive resolvers, meaning that they will make queries to other DNS servers to get their answer. That if they don't have the information directly, they'll get it from someone else and cache it. You will usually will cache it. They don't have to cache it, but usually they will cache it. And this recursive resolver, this is the type of DNS server you get from DHCP. If your machine has a configuration dialog where it asks you to type in the address of DNS servers, this is the type of DNS server you're typing in the address of. Our web browsers and so on, they know how to contact a DNS server. They don't know how to do the recursive queries themselves. They don't know how to contact other DNS servers based on the DNS server. That is something they delegate to one of these recursive resolvers. And which of these your DNS server is typically the choice of whoever configures it. So most DNS server software, or I guess not most, but sort of the full-featured DNS server software that can be an authoritative DNS server can also be a recursive resolver generally. It's just a matter of what you set the configuration to. Usually these are mutually exclusive, but that's not required. But usually you'll either set something up as an authoritative DNS server or as a recursive resolver and not both, but you could do both. So we mentioned we had this kind of chain of resolution, and there's a tool we can use to do DNS queries, which I'm going to show many examples of the output of, called dig. And dig is a command line tool that comes with, I believe, it comes with the bind DNS server. So it's written uses the same code base as one of the major, probably the most used DNS server out there called Bind. And here I'm running a command where I run dig plus trace, which tells it to resolve starting at the root. So dig can do all the recursive querying, and that's what it's doing here. And I'm telling it to resolve www.cs.virginia.edu, and it's starting with what a root DNS server, meaning a DNS server for this zone, the dot zone. And from that zone, it gets some records saying that here, and we'll talk, go over this record format again, but we have a domain name, a time to live in seconds, the class, which is always going to be internet. The DNS originally had ambitions of being used for non-internet things. I don't think that's happened. And NS, which means name server. So this first record here, these first set of records here, tell us that we have a domain name edu has the name server b.eduservers.net, and f.eduservers.net, and i.eduservers.net, and a.eduservers.net. And a name server, what that means is that's saying that these are authoritative name servers for things in the EDU zone. And the time to live says you can catch this information for 172,800 seconds. After that, you should check again and see if it got updated. Now, knowing if we actually want to contact those servers, of course, we need to know their IP addresses. So helpfully, our response has also included their IP addresses. And I didn't show the full output, it includes the other IP addresses too. And we can see we have both actually IPv4 and IPv6 addresses in this case. And as you can see, Dig is saying that it got this information from a root server, which has the name h.rootservers.net. The pound sign is separating the IP address and the port number, so it's port 53 of that IP address. So questions about sort of our first part of this output? So Dig sees this, and it's going to choose one of the name servers it got here. And in my example, it chose one I didn't show in the slide, which is c.eduservers.net, and it's going to get a response from there, and that's going to have similarly say, now here are authoritative name servers for the Virginia.edu zone, and here are their IP addresses. It happens that UVA doesn't use IPv6, so they only have IPv4 addresses. And then what does Dig do? It chooses one of these servers and contacts it to get the actual thing we're looking for, right, which is www.cs.virginia.edu. So it contacts one of the Virginia.edu authoritative servers, and that says, oh, no, cs.virginia.edu, that's different. The name authoritative server, cs.virginia.edu, that's going to be CoreServe 01 at the time I did this slide. If you check it now, it's something different. And then we send a query to CoreServe 01, and we finally get our final answer with the IP address of www.cs.virginia.edu. Okay. So questions about our sort of full recursive lookup. So that's the full recursive lookup, but typically what's going to happen is we're going to query a resolver and we'll have a cache entry for this. And one thing you can notice here is that when I got the www entry, right, we had this valid for a very long time, very high TTL. When I get my cached entry, it has a lower number because, well, it's been cached for a long time. So it's been, you know, it's how much longer can you keep this cached for, which is based on how much longer can I keep this cached for. I'm going to pass that information on to you. Okay. So something you might say about this is that, boy, is Digg's output ugly. You know, why do we have these funny names here and this weird, why do we have this trailing dots and all that stuff? And maybe it is ugly, but this is actually a standardized format. So DNS on the network doesn't send things like this. It sends things in a compact binary format. But there's a standardized presentation format, which is what Digg is mostly outputting. It doesn't quite match, but it's very close. And this format is used for DNS server configuration files. So if you're setting up a DNS server, you're going to write a config file which has lines that look very much like this. To do that. And that's what I'm going to try to use in most of my slides, is this standardized presentation format or something like it. Okay, so we saw the time to live. And this is kind of one of the most important things about what makes DNS practical. And this is because we need a way to remove out-of-date records, but we want lots of caching to happen. And so what DNS does is there's no sort of coordination about when I'm updating a record. Instead, we just tell you it's valid for this long, and we have to set those times as a system administrator to correspond to how we would like to update records. And we saw that this is decremented when recursive resolvers return a cached entry. Like, they're not going to tell you the time to live is the original time. They're going to tell you it's how long the original time minus how long it's been since I got it. So think about that. And some of you may have seen these exercises. I'm reusing some things I've done in CSO2, but not every semester. So sorry if this is duplicated for people. But so let's say I have a record, you know, that has a time to live of 86,400 seconds for WCSW.edu, which is would look like virginia.edu.in86400 in a 128.148.67.11. So let's say that's my DNS record. What happens if I change it to have a different IP address? So we have a bunch of possibilities here. What do we think will happen? So I'll do a show of hands. So who thinks it will be A, that after 86,400 seconds, they'll start using the new address, and before then, we should expect just the old address. Okay, a few people. Who thinks B, that it will be different times, but no longer than 86,400 seconds? Okay. Who thinks C, that we'll have a quick changeover, but some solid length? Who thinks D, that machines will start using things until they're rebooted? And who thinks E? Okay, so most people got, I think, the best answer, which is that what should happen, how the time to live is supposed to work, is that some machines are going to have the value cached. So those machines are going to potentially use it for up to 86,400 seconds. Some machines are going to have the value cached, but have it cached a while ago, in which case they'll need to check the server when that expired. So let's say they got it 30,000 seconds ago, That means in 40,000 seconds, or around 50,000 seconds, they'll have to check the server again, and they'll get the new IP. So we'll have a range of times in between, depending on when they last got the address. Now, this assumes that people are implementing the time to lives correctly, and it's not unheard of for people to get that wrong, in which case maybe some broken machines are doing deep. Hopefully not. Hopefully you don't have to tell people to restart their machine to contact your server. Yes?
If someone requests the IP if they change the IP but someone requests it before the cache expires, will it just not work?
If they change the IP but someone requests the IP before the cache expires, will it just not work? They'll just use the old IP. So a typical way as a system administrator you make this work is, I guess there's, well, actually we'll have that as the next slide. But that's a question, like, how do we make this efficient? And we'll talk about our options on the next slide. How do we make this actually work? But yes, they'll contact the old IP, that's how it works, until the cache entry expires. Other questions here? So let's get to the question you asked, which is like you were hinting at, which is how can we make this a smooth transition? So what should we do to make this a smooth transition? And a key sort of idea, is that we can change the TTLs to make that work. To make that work. So can someone suggest, like, what should I do if I want to change the IP address of www of the server in DNS to make this go more smoothly, given that we know what happens here? If I'm planning to change it, I should say. Right. Yeah. So decrease TTL first, yeah. So a typical thing you would do is, before you do the changeover, probably decrease TTL, first, a lot of seconds before you do the changeover. And you might change the TTL to something like 60 or something. Now, this is going to make your DNS server get a lot more requests temporarily, but it means that now, after you wait long enough for the high TTL stuff to expire, now everyone's only keeping things around for like 60 seconds. And you can change over the IP address then with the 60-second TTL, and you only have to wait a minute after that for the old server to stop being used. And so what you probably would do is you make sure both IP addresses work when you're doing that changeover in that 1 minute, but after that, you can churn off the old server and things should be fine. This, of course, requires that you plan ahead 86,400 seconds to lower the TTL. If you don't do that, and you need to change the IP address for an emergency reason, well, too bad. Your website won't work for everyone. Okay, so questions about So applying this, so let's say I have foo.com's DNS server is initially this, and we have the sort of NS record TTL is that long, and then we change it to a different TTL and www. So when will the new server and newfoo.com start being used. Someone tell me, when do they start being used? And we're changing over at t equals 0 seconds. Time, you know, t equals 0, right? It's our base time. So when relative to that base time will our new DNS server and new web server start being used? Change both of those IPs. No. So let's go with, so who thinks it's going to be at least 100 seconds? Okay. Who think it's going to be less than 100 seconds? And no clue. Okay, so a tricky thing about this is that not everyone starts using it at the same time. So the answer is right away. For, you know, people who don't have a cached version. So the new one will start being used right away, but not by everyone. So that's why the second question is different than the first one. When the new one starts being used, is not the same as when we can shut the old one down. So we can shut down the old DNS server, you know, in 200 seconds when its record expires. When people who have cached that foo.com's DNS server is 10.2.3.4 no longer have that cached. We can shut down the old foo.com when its record expires, because people will only have that cached for 100 seconds. I'm assuming that when we changed both of these records, we changed what www.foo.com was on both DNS servers, both the old and new one. If we didn't do that, we're going to have to wait an extra 200 seconds. Assuming old DNS server gives the new www IP. Okay, so questions? Okay. So, talked about DNS zones, and I mentioned we had this root zone, and this is kind of one of the most important pieces of infrastructure. And there are 13 root servers, kind of. We'll talk in a sec. And this is a list from INA's website, which coordinates this, you know, coordinates all the root domains of the IP addresses. Each of them has an IPv4 and IPv6 address. And they're A through M. .rootservers.net is their domain name. And if you want to have a recursive resolver, often what you'll do is you hard code this table. You just have this table in your software. So you might say 13 servers, well, that's a lot for the entire internet. And you might say, where are these servers? And here's a map, kind of. And the numbers on this map indicate how many root servers are in that area. And you might say, wait a moment. You have 13 here. Where does this 376 come from? Like, what's happening there, right? How do we have more servers than we had listed names and IP addresses? Like, what's going on with that? And well, if we have, you know, several hundred servers, and it seems like we have 1,912 total, what they call instances, that's split across only 13 IPv4 addresses and 13 IPv6 addresses, it must be the case that several of these instances have the same IP addresses. And that's precisely what happens, that we deliberately run multiple machines with the same IP address at different locations, like, in fact, very different locations, like spread across the globe from each other locations. And this idea is called Anycast. And DNS is probably the place where it comes up the most, but it's something you can actually use for like a website. That you can run a web server with one IP address that is actually like different web servers. You know, you have like one web server in Boston and one web server in LA. That's something you can do. And well, how do people decide which one they contact? Well, that decision's made by routing. In the case of the root servers, like BGP is going to decide which one you get to is based on which BGP route does your ISP choose. Do they choose the one to the Boston instance or the LA instance? So this is how most of the root servers work, is most of them use this Anycast idea, and they deliberately have multiple disconnected sites that announce the same IP address. And depending which one you go to, you're going to get a different version of the root server. And this idea is also used by some prominent public recursive DNS servers. So Google and Cloudflare and Cisco all run public recursive DNS resolvers that they widely advertise. You can just configure your machines to use, and pretty much all of these are run using this Anycast idea, that they have one IP address, but there are multiple servers that corresponds to, and which one you get depends on what network you're connected to. And I said that this is commonly used with DNS, and you can use it for things like websites. It's a lot less common for websites because you have other options for websites. For DNS, we don't really have another option, right? We have to have people use the IP address, because if they're not using the IP address, they need to look up the IP address with DNS. And that would be a circular dependency we can't handle. Okay. Some questions about Anycast? And I guess I would say, like, conceptually, this is simple, like, you just advertise multiple routes from different places. For doing this well, like, this is a case where we'd, like, do lots of stuff with BGP communities and AS prepending, because a part of making Anycast work well is carefully managing which route do different ISPs take to you to make it be match the sort of best performance choice. Okay, so that's the root servers. And the root servers all use the same zone file, sort of the sort of list of domain names in the root, which IANA publishes periodically. And this is the same organization that we saw handled IP address assignments and AS numbers. But I would say domain names is definitely the most politically active part of what they do. It's the thing that people have the most political concerns about, most regulations about, most legislation about. The IP address stuff is pretty mundane in comparison. So IPv4 stuff, controversial because there's scarcity. The IPv6 stuff is like pretty uncontroversial because you know, they have plenty of IPv6 addresses to give you. And of course, the zone file contains what we'll call top-level domains. So top-level domains, you know, you've seen .com, .edu, .uk. That's what top-level domains are, things that are just under the root name. And for each of them, there are registries that maintain the list of domains in that name and also are responsible for coordinating the authoritative servers for that zone. So for example, VeriSign runs CommonNet is the registry for CommonNet. EduCause, which is a nonprofit, is the registry for EDU. Registry Services LLC, which is a sort of contracting company for the US Department of Commerce, runs .us. And these handle the responsibility of maintaining the list of all the domain name, all the delegations. So it's going to mostly, it's not going to be like every web server address in com that VeriSign's maintaining. They're maintaining all the delegations to other name servers. All that information about, you know, foo.com's name server is, authoritative name server is this address and this address. That's the information they're handling. And these registries are different than who you buy domain names from. So typically, you buy domain names from registrars who contact the registry. But you don't actually talk to the registry directly or pay the registry directly. And this is why you can buy, you know, a .com domain name from thousands of different places, because there is this kind of separation of those two concerns. So let's talk about kind of the DNS format. And each of those lines we saw, you know, that's kind of a DNS database entry, is called in the DNS standard a resource record, or RR. And it has a standard text representation, like we've seen, and a standard binary representation, which we're going to give some examples of. So let's do this example here. So I have my text representation, www.csrvnedu172800 in a and an IP address. And how this is represented as a sequence of bytes is we have the byte 3, we have the ASCII www, the byte 2, the ASCII CS, and basically we're doing each label prefixed by its size in bytes. And if you want a label to be longer than bits in a byte, you can't do that. In fact, labels are limited to 64 bytes, so you can't even use the full length of the byte. And then we terminate with a zero. And if you saw that, like, we have this trailing dot, like, kind of where that comes from is that zero and that zero terminator, we can kind of think of each domain name ending with an empty label, which is represented by that zero. That's where that notation comes from. And then we have a type and a class. So the class is going to be pretty much always internet, and the type is, you know, going to tell us the type of information. In this case, we have A for IPv4 address. And then we have the length of the data. We have a length here because even though I know this is 4 bytes because it's an IPv4 address, the idea is that if you don't know all the types, you can still process the records. So a DNS server might return you records of types you don't understand, and that's fine, you can just ignore them. But you need the length information to do that. And we have our time to live, and so on. And all these things are going to be sort of big endian numbers. If you don't remember what big endian is, that's most significant byte first. So questions on this format? Okay. So one thing that the designers of DNS were very concerned about was saving space in packets. Maybe that's not super obvious here, but one way that reflects is that this is not the only way of representing names. That there's something that DNS calls name compression sometimes. where the idea is that often in a DNS response, we have multiple things that refer to the same domain name. And in this example, like I might have dub.cs.virginia.edu in A is an IP address, and I might have CoreServe cs.virginia.edu has a name server of CoreServe01A.cs.virginia.edu. And you see, as I've written things out, I have to write cs.virginia.edu three times. And that's something that they said, we don't want to send a packet with three copies of cs.virginia.edu. Or if we're like thinking of like the more bigger scenarios with, you know, probably like 10 copies of eduservers.net. So to avoid that, they have this name compression idea where we can have a pointer to a prior copy of some set of domains, and we'll just jump to that pointer and keep going to process the name. And the pointer is specified as an offset in bytes from the beginning of the message. Plus, they add this sort of, they set the upper bits so we know it's not a normal label. So this gray part here represents that the upper two bits of the first byte are set to one. So we know it's not a normal size. And as I said, this is because like it's pretty apparent that the original designers of DNS were really concerned about saving space in packets. And we'll see a big reason for that is that the original version of DNS had a useful size limit of 512 bytes. Which meant, you know, they were being really careful with this space. Okay, so we have our basic format, and I mentioned we have these types, so let's talk about some record types. We've kind of seen a bunch of them. We have A for IPv4 addresses. We have quadruple A for IPv6 addresses. And kind of the history here is that they didn't start supporting IPv6, so they added it on, and they name things interestingly to do that. And I assume the AAA is because it's four times an IPv4 address. We have NS for an authoritative name server. And we have a few other types I'll talk about specifically. We have CNAME, text, and serve. And as you can see from these ID numbers, there's obviously a whole bunch of others I'm not showing you. And each of these kind of has different information that goes in the data format. That's why we have a variable length there, you know, including having a domain name in the data format or having some other information. So let's talk about CNAME. So CNAME, which stands for canonical name, is a way of kind of delegating one name to another. And an example of this is how UVA sets up canvas.its.virginia.edu. That UVA is paying someone else to run it, and they want to have it go to different IP addresses at different times. So one way we could have this happen is they could send a configuration information to UVA's DNS server, and UVA's DNS server could update its IP addresses all the time. But that's kind of annoying to set up and hard to set up. So what we've done instead is that UVA's DNS server has this kind of static entry which says that canvas.its.virginia.edu, you know, has a canonical name of universityofvirginia-vanity.instructure.com, meaning that when you go to canvas.virginia.edu, when we look that up, we use the other name, the instructure.com name, to actually look it up. So if we're doing our recursive query, if I'm trying to figure out what's the actual IP address, when I see the CNAME, I'm going to go say, okay, now to find Canvas's IP address, I need to query this domain name's IP address. And if I query that, I get another CNAME record that it gets delegated from Instructure to Amazon AWS. And finally, Amazon AWS for this third name we found gives us the actual IP addresses we can use. And we have a selection of IP addresses. We can have multiple IP addresses for one host, in which case you should be able to use any of them. Some questions about CNAMEs? Yeah, and I would say if we're doing a recursive lookup, probably what would happen is we'd contact, virginia.edu servers for this, we contact Instructure servers for this, and we contact Amazon servers for this. So we'd have sort of three separate queries to build this information. And the records at each stage note that they have their own time to live, so we can cache each of them if we want to. We saw NS servers, so these say that here are the authoritative servers for Virginia.edu. NS records only have the server name, so for them to be useful, we probably also need to be sent the quadruple A records for the domain, for the servers. Okay. I mentioned one thing here, which is this serve record. So this is for identifying a service. So an example of this is, I truncated this thing here. So you have to imagine that this here says VID and VIZs. That's what these things that are truncated off the slide are, those two names. And a serve record says, for a particular service over a particular protocol, here's how you find the server for, in this case, for Virginia.edu. So for Virginia.edu's LDAP services, contact it over TCP, use vidc4.virginia.edu port 389 or vidc5.virginia.edu port 389. LDAP is a protocol for looking up like email addresses by names. If you configure this in your mail client, you can like type most people's names if they're in the public directory and get their email, or type their email and get their name. And this seems really nice, that this is kind of a generic way we can run multiple services. We just have a standardized name for each of them, and we can have Virginia.edu run these servers without having them all have to be on, the same physical machine with the same IP address. And you just type Virginia.edu and you get Virginia, but you use whatever server, and you use chat server, and you use web server. So you think we use these all the time, and we don't. There's only a few protocols that use serve records. LDAP is one of them. And mail does something similar, but mail has its own record type called MX records that predates serve records. And basically the issue is that serve records were added too late. Mail already had its mechanism, and web servers already had the convention of www dot, which is how people dealt with that issue, the issue of wanting to run a web server and some other servers on your domain. And people just got used to using some service name dot something dot com rather than this sort of intended mechanism where you just have the main domain name is the name for everything, and you can just automatically figure out where the server for that thing is. But that's what was the intention. It just didn't kind of really work out, except for these handful of services. The other kind of issue with using serve records is that there's kind of a practical issue. That we're going to talk about sockets as our next topic, and socket libraries provide extremely poor support for using serve records. It's really easy to connect to a host and IP address. It's really hard to connect based on a serve record with most socket libraries. And that's just because not enough people care about it, so they didn't write a library for you to call, write call connect to LDAP server, conveniently. So people writing LDAP clients need to actually do a whole bunch of work to implement a bunch of DNS stuff, even though, or find a DNS library that's not the one of the standard networking libraries in the system. The other thing, as we'll talk about later a bit more, is that it's surprisingly hard in many cases to get access to add things to DNS. And because serve records are kind of exotic, many ways, many sort of interfaces for adding things to DNS aren't going to support them. And if you're trying to deploy serve records, this is kind of a practical issue. It's easy to make sure your server has an IP address with a domain name, because that's kind of an automatic thing to set up. Setting up serve records isn't automatic, so there's often like a complicated process for getting someone who has access to the right config file to type it in. Okay, so I also mentioned here text records, and these contain arbitrary strings. And this kind of looks like, you know, when you read this description here, you're like, it just contains strings. Like, surely that's just like a minor thing, not, you know, just like for human use. So let's look at the result of querying Virginia.edu for text records. There are a lot of them. We've sure used these arbitrary strings that don't have any inherent meaning a lot. And it looks like, you know, these are designed to be read by machines. Like, probably we aren't expecting a human to read that. So you have a whole bunch of them. So there's a lot of text records that, you know, are used for some machine-based users. Like this Google site verification is probably used by Google to verify something about the owner of Virginia.edu. We'll talk about this specific SPF record, but you have all these things that, you know, are meant for some programmatic usage. And you might say, wait, we made a separate record type for services. You made a separate record type for authoritative servers, for aliases. Why don't we have a new record type for this? Did we run out of numbers? Something? And the answer is probably more inertia than anything else. That, yeah, it probably would make sense to have a new record type for verifying ownership of domain that it seems like we've used a whole bunch of text records for here. But it's really hard to add new record types to DNS servers, DNS configuration software, and so on, so we don't. Instead, we just reuse text records. And maybe sort of a big prominent example of this is one of the records here, which is for SPF. So you can see this record is prefixed with VSPF equals 1. And this is a protocol for specifying who can send email from a domain. So the domain is Virginia.edu. And the way this works is we put in DNS a text record starting with VSPF equals 1, saying who can send that. And we have kind of a list of IP addresses that can send email and other information about who can send email. And you might say, this sure looks like structured data. You know, that could have a nicer format. Why is it in a text record? Why doesn't it have its own record type? And the SPF people actually have a record type. Let's talk about that story. And they document what happened in an appendix of RFC 6686, which standardizes SPF. And they said, so at the time of their initial development, getting a new RR type assigned, getting a new type ID assigned, was very hard. There were these strict standards. So they didn't do it. But, you know, SPF was around for a while, and they got an RR type assigned. RR type 99 is SPF. So they have their own record type. And they plan to transition to that record type from the type 16, which is text. And they listed 4 reasons it failed to take effect. The first 2, I think, are the most interesting. So one reason is that even though we've carefully designed our resource records to have like a length, so you don't have to know what the type is to just ignore the record, a lot of DNS servers and firewalls you know, like recursive resolvers would just reject requests for RR type 90i because they didn't know about it. Even though it's supposed to be something you can pass through without understanding it, people didn't write their DNS servers and resolvers that way. Also, a lot of DNS provisioning tools, by which they mean things like a web interface that your ISP gives you to configure your domain names, didn't allow you to make new record, didn't add support for new record types. You know, they had text support because text records are very old. They didn't have support for these new types. They weren't interested in adding it. So that's kind of the, and another example of the internet being having lots of inertia. You know, that why our protocols kind of look the way they do. So questions about our record types, or subset of interesting record types? Okay, so one thing is we talked about DNS zones, and we have these list of records. Typically, we're going to have multiple DNS servers for each zones. Like, you don't have to do this, but if you want to handle outages, you better do this. And the DNS protocol supports zone transfers to synchronize between two DNS servers. And it's designed to support this so we can have a primary DNS server for a zone and secondaries where you don't have to copy your config files to the secondaries. Instead, they use the DNS protocol to contact the primary server and automatically update. And to support this, there's another record type called SOA, for start of authority, that gives kind of information about the zone, saying who's the primary server for the zone, what version of the zone do we have now, how often should you update automatically if you're a secondary server, and so on. So there's a special record type mainly to coordinate between the primary and secondaries for a zone. The idea being that you can just set up a secondary server and you're done. Okay, so we talked about DNS records. Let's talk about how DNS messages work. So typically our client sends a query to the server and the server responds with a response, and DNS has messages have the same format in both directions. So even though the query and the response are different, they have the same format. And our format looks like this. So we have an ID number that identifies the request for the client to use. We have some flags. Most notably, we have a flag indicating if this is a query or response, because remember, we use the same format for both. Some indicating if it's authoritative. Some indicating if it's if the query should be recursive or not. So we can request that a recursive resolver not resolve it recursively. And also, the server can tell us back, do I support recursive queries or not with these flags. We have an opcode. So we'll only see queries, but there's other operations that are supported, like zone transfers are a different opcode. And we have a response code, which is typically going to be 0, but this is where we say, like, domain does not exist. So, and, okay, I should talk about some other things. So we have these questions. So these questions are name, class, and type. So they're basically a record without the time to live or the data. So we have a list of questions. There's QD count of them, which is always 0 or 1. Then we have a list of answers, authorities. So this is answer, authorities, and additional records. And so one sort of special case here is I mentioned that we have this response code, which is 0 for no error. If we do have an error, there's an issue that we want to cache some errors. We want to cache domain name does not exist. And this is something they didn't originally think about in DNS. So they added support for that where you have to figure out how long can I cache it? And their solution is that they use that start of authority record, and they base the time to live on that information, because that says how often the domain name is, the secondaries are updated. So they use that information to determine the time to live. Basically, based on the TTL of the SOA, TTL of that record, or the update frequency in that record. So we have our thing, so we saw our header, we have a question, which is a domain name class of type. There's actually a special type value any, though it's not actually super useful. We have answers, and we have authority and additional record, resource records. So the answers are things that like correspond to your query. So either, you know, are the name and type and class, or from CNAMES. The authority are NS records, and the additional section typically includes any corresponding IP addresses of the for the NS record. Because if I tell you, you know, foo.com's DNS server is ns.foo.com, you need to know what's the IP address of ns.foo.com. That's what the additional section is going to be used for. And DNS supports kind of multiple different ways of working. We can have it over UDP, which is kind of what it was originally designed for, and we can have it over TCP. So with UDP, we just send a single UDP packet. UDP is just a datagram protocol. With TCP, we're sending a stream, so we need sizes. The way they handle that is we send a 2-byte size before every message in both directions. And it's all, we all saw at the beginning of class, it can be done over HTTPS, where we make a, basically a web request to server name slash DNS query with the DNS message inside the request. So one thing you might say, why do we support UDP and TCP? So the DNS designers really want to use UDP because it's the most efficient way, but it has a size limit. So for example, we saw that there's lots of text entries for reunited.eu. If I try to query them with UDP, so here I'm telling Dig, don't use TCP. Dig still uses TCP. It says, couldn't do that. It got truncated because there's a size limit for UDP. And originally, the size limit was 512 bytes. That's really small. And this is why there are 13 root servers, because 13 NS records, 13 A records, 480 bytes or so. So as I said, there's extensions to increase the DNS size, record size. So the big thing is that, big problem with that is that if you look at this here, there's no place for like extension information. So what the DNS designers decided to do is they said, we're going to put kind of the options in here. We're going to add a resource record that doesn't represent an actual domain name. It represents, like, I want to support larger UDP packets, please. And this is called eDNS0. And this most notably supports a larger maximum size over UDP. And we can actually see that here, we're being told about the extra sort of record that's sent with the request, that it represents that information by Dig. That it's saying, hey, I support this extended DNS, and I support 64K UDP packets, by the way. Okay. And I probably shouldn't try to cover cache poisoning today. So I think there's an assignment on DNS that's for next week. I think we know enough to do it. You'll probably have to refer to the references there. Basically, the assignment is you're going to be constructing a request message and processing response messages to extract like the IP address, or if there's no IP address, the name server address to contact, or if there's none of that, like the CNAME to look up. Yeah, that is, so basically processing requests and responses and writing some Python code to do that. So questions about that? Okay, So see you all next week.